As unaccustomed as I am to public speaking, I don't think I can get started unless I introduce myself, as we always do in our AA meetings in Texas. I'm Esther, and I'm an alcoholic. And from following the program of AA to the best of my ability, I was dry 12 years yesterday. But I know this, that the only way that I can maintain my sobriety is to remember always what I was like 12 years ago this weekend. I am shaking like a leaf all over this morning. But at least I know where I am, and that if I continue to do daily what I have done in these last 12 years, I will stay sober till I die. I didn't know that when I came in. I knew that I wanted to try AA, but that it would work, well, I didn't think anything would work. And I think that we have to do time in AA before we realize that it's going to work for us. I wish I could tell you how and why AA works. I don't know. I only know that it does. If you desire it with your whole heart and without reservation, I think that none of us come to AA until we've tried everything we can think of. I know that I had thought that if only I had found AA years before I did, that I would have saved myself so much of the shame and degradation of the last few years. But as I've grown in AA, I realize that a person with as much self-will as I had, and as hard a head, and as diseased an ego, that I had to try everything that I could think of and bump my head up against every stone wall before I was ready to come in. The only thing I have really and truly to offer you is my own story and to tell you just what sort of a drunk I was. It's kind of hard seeing me up here sober and clean and smiling to think that I was ever in the horrible shape that I was. You know, I came from a family where alcohol was very socially accepted. I lived in New Orleans, Louisiana, and there were cocktail lounges and ballrooms. It was just something that was served openly. I'm an Episcopalian, and we bless our sacraments with wine. I can't remember a dinner at home that we didn't have white wine and claret on the table. There were not cocktails served when I was growing up. I think the family used to drink sherry every now and then, and we always had cordial after dinner. And I know my sister and my brother and I loved creme de menthe. It was like a snowball, you know, scraped ice with the green and a little straw. So I was used to it, but I didn't know what the effect of alcohol was because I would have claret maybe with my dinner, but there was a lot of ice and about 2 tablespoons of claret with a little water and some sugar. And eating it with your meals, you didn't feel. I think the first time, in fact, I know that I ever realized what alcohol would do for me was when I married. All my life, I didn't think that I was maladjusted, but I know now I was. In spite of coming from a home that was happy, I had a very indulgent father and everything, I was an extremely sensitive person and so self-conscious that I just hurt all over all the time. And the night that I married, I had a big church wedding. And I couldn't enjoy anything. I know they were saying this present is come, and I had this girl from St. Louis down for my wedding. She was staying with us. I was just scared to death that my dress wasn't going to do right, that the church wasn't going to be filled, that I'd fall flat on my face walking up the aisle. In fact, I was just frightened to death that I wasn't going to be a prima donna at the place that I should be a prima donna. And in those days and times, you know, I've been married 29 years. That's been before God. You didn't carry a little orchid up the aisle. You carried these great big bouquets like a funeral spray. And you didn't have your pictures taken until just before you went to the church. They're very kind brides now. I think they have their pictures taken 2 or 3 days ahead of time. Well, as self-conscious as I was, I had to be dressed about 2 or 3 hours before going to church and pose for these pictures, holding this huge, enormous thing. And I would love for y'all to see those pictures sometimes. I look like somebody's digging me in the back with a sword. Baptist Church and they had finished, I really was in a terrific state. And my father looked at me and he turned to the servants right there and he said, Miss Esther is about to faint. Get her something to drink. Well, the servant he turned to was our old cook. And we had some waiters from the club there and all. And she was one of the guests at the wedding, you know, and she liked to drink. And poor lady went in the kitchen and she came back with a water glass. And it was half full of time. And I drank it down. The church is just 3 blocks from the house. It was February and it was cold. And I got right into the car and they drove me over. And as soon as I hit the church, they started the wedding. And baby, when I hit the aisle, that whiskey went right through me. Never have I felt so good. I walked up that aisle just like Mae West in her prime. But I went up and then I went to it over again. I don't think that I was conscious of what had happened to me. I think I was very happy. But I enjoyed it. But I think that it registered subconsciously. And do you know that that drink was wonderful for me? It was really medicinal that night. And it was on many occasions after that. I learned that it eased the situation socially. And it helped us fine. But somewhere along the line, it backfired. And when I passed that line, I don't know, when something just went haywire and I got to depend on it so I could do nothing without it. I think that it was in about 1931 that my drinking first caused comment. And nobody was very perturbed about it, except my family. Because I decided after 7 years of marriage that I would divorce my husband. So the night that I married, I must tell you, I was very hard-headed and quite a problem at home. And my mother told my husband, he says, thank goodness she's off my hands, but you sure have got your hands full. More than he really did. But anyhow, I decided to divorce him, and I did in July. It don't take some months to get one in Dallas, and I was living in Dallas at the time. And I went on home. Well, I really was pretty white, over 21, and I had a time. I put my poor mother and father through the agonies of the damned. And finally, I couldn't stand living with them, watching everything I could do, and my husband was coming down, and I don't know, I had no feeling of security or anything else. It was a very asinine thing that I did when I did get the divorce, and finally I went back to Dallas, and we married. And we moved up to Tulsa, and that was when all the boys and Esther got drunk, and the wives didn't, and they would talk about it, and that went on for about 3 years, and then we moved back to Dallas. And then I started drinking. And Frank would come home day after day and finally passed out. Or he'd leave on a trip, and every time he came home, he passed out. So finally he said to me one morning, Esther, why do you do this? And I said, well, I don't know why. But I've been reading a lot about psychiatry, and I thought, well, maybe if I talk to a psychiatrist, he could find out some mental quirk and put me straight and then I could drink like a lady. So Frank said, well, if you'd like to talk to one, I'll see a doctor and find out who to go to here. So Frank left with my problem and to get the doctor and all, so I got drunk. And when he came home, he had found a doctor. They didn't want to take an alcoholic first. He didn't call me back. But it was because I was drinking too much. But then when he told the doctor that I wanted to talk to him, the doctor said, yes. So I got drunker and drunker, and then I woke up in a booby hat. You know, I had never been on the inside of an insane asylum. And I had really thought I was going to a private hospital. And I woke up in this bare room with nothing around me but these bars. There were no cigarettes. They wouldn't let me smoke, and they just treated me well, like I was nuts, but of course I didn't think I was. I know this. The right away I got furious, and I would not even talk to the doctor in the place. I wanted to come home. They kept me there, and I was supposed to stay a month, but they only kept me there 17 days. I know that I was terribly screwed up when I went in, but I came out much worried because I could not identify myself with the people that I was with, and there was no understanding, and I can't stand confinement, and it was just all these things, and I had hysterics on the 17th day for the first and only time in my life. So they let me go home. And the doctor let me go home on one condition, because he asked me if I would cooperate with him after I went home, and that if I would have a trainer stay with me for at least 2 weeks. So all those conditions, regardless of the cost or anything else, I said yes. Well, I was so happy over getting home, and I changed this overnight. I was crazy about Dr. Hack. His name is Dr. Witt, and I've been calling him Dr. Hackwit. So I know that I said for years after, this was in 1936 or 37, that I cooperated with that man 100%. And that is how dishonest I was with myself. I know now that I answered all his questions and told him what I wanted to. And then I told him what I wanted to believe about myself. The questions he asked me that I didn't answer honestly, I thought were none of his damn business. And I could see no reason, or not a reason why they had any relation to this problem of getting drunk every now and then. So I know that it drove me further into the psychosis that I had, or whatever you want to call it. And I hated, deep down in my heart, I resented the fact that Frank had done this to me. And I just didn't know what way I was going. And life was pretty miserable. Well, about this time at Christmas, after I had been in Dr. Witt's place, after 6 months of being under his care, we just decided that there wasn't anything more to do. Every time I got drunk, he'd send me to a nursing home. He had better sense than send me back to that hospital. I think I just ruptured the hospital. But anyhow, when we got back from Christmas, my husband had given me a Cocker Spaniel, who is my heart, and I think just as notorious in AA as I am now. You know, when you get so bad in, your dog won't have anything to do with you when you're drinking, it's pretty rough. But that's the way it got. And Frank had to go to New York. Well, because I had a dog, I just had a duplex, and I thought, if only we had a house. A duplex apartment isn't any place to raise a dog. So I went out and started the Samaritan treatment. He even had the people come out there and tell me what kind of a room I was going to have, and that he could come see me, and that my dog could come see me, you know, all the things that I couldn't have when I was in the rehab. So I took the Samaritan treatment. Well, I guess there are plenty of other graduates in Samaritan treatment in here. There are no easy ways to sober up, without a doubt, though. That's the most excruciating. It's the IRT treatment. So I took that 3 times, and that didn't work. Then there was a minister at the church. He tried to help me. There was a doctor in the congregation that was pretty interested in me, and he thought it was a vitamin deficiency. So I would go down to him for quite a few months, and have him ship me full of all this stuff, medical arts building. I'd go across the street to that little triangle drugstore, and I would take a glass of beer, 2 beers, and stop at the liquor store and get myself a pint, and I got home, and you know those vitamins just don't keep you sober. The best. Finally, in 1940, we went down to Houston, and my husband thought maybe a change of environment, a new town and everything else, I would be all right. We moved down in 1940, and that year was my last. There was nothing else but to try. We had tried everything. So the only thing that I could do would be call a doctor to help sober me up. I wouldn't go to hospitals because I wanted my dog there. And so I had to have a trained nurse. And the only time my dog had anything to do with me was when I had a hangover, you know, and I was so sick. And he'd come, and he's the only one that wouldn't have anything to do with me. Well, I don't know. It was a tragic thing. I have told you some of the funny things, but not much of the shame and degradation. I fell down and knocked out my front teeth. I dropped a 2-quart water bottle on my big toe, and I couldn't walk, had in a cast, And the doctor left it on 3 weeks longer than he should because he never found me sober so he could take it off. He was afraid as soon as he took it off, I'd break it over again. Well, my dress caught on fire by the bathroom. Gilly and I didn't sit down for 3 months. And it was one thing after another. So finally, one afternoon in April of 1941, I got as drunk as a skunk. And all of you that know me so well know that I do not walk straight sober. But you should see me when I'm drunk. And I was as drunk as I could be. And it was time for that afternoon walk. I had on a pair of denim slacks, and out I go, weaving with the dog. And a patrol car passes. And they must have seen what condition I was in. I mean, they could tell what condition I was in. And decided to take me home. But when they picked me up, I must have got kind of sassy and told them they couldn't do that to Mrs. Elizari. Because they took my dog home and they brought me to jail. Well, as I said before, I don't like to be fenced in. Those bars. You don't get hotel service. No. I know they told my husband that they took me home. There wasn't anyone there, and I was in such terrible condition they didn't know what I would do to myself. And they realized there was no place for me. But for him to wait a while before he got me, because at that time, when they called him to come over for me, I was knocking a tin cup up against the wall. I wanted some cigarette service, of which I didn't get. So I was in just a few hours. But somewhere during that time, I remember going back on this bunk and just crying my eyes out. I think that is when I hit bottom. I didn't think that I could ever be... I mean, I just know that I went completely haywire on the inside. And yet still, we had this defensive front. So many people say, oh, he doesn't want to sober up, or she doesn't want to sober up. Stop and think of your behavior. My husband couldn't tell that I wanted to do something about it by looking at me. I was as defiant as anybody could be because I was too scared. I didn't know which way to turn. So when he came for me, as I walked down this gate, I could see him through these bars, and he was signing something. And I looked at him, and I said, don't you sign anything in this place. You know, I was going to sue the city of Houston for what they did to a place like myself. But Frank turned around, and he looked at me, and he said, Esther, remember, you're in jail, not at home. And my friends, I never want anybody to look at me like that again. With the contempt and everything else that was in his face and voice. I think I read more contempt there than was really there, because just a week before, someone had sent him the Saturday Evening Post article on AA. And there was some glimmer in it of hope for him that there was something maybe else that I could try. But he was frightened to death to give it to me, because I resented everything he said and did. So he waited another week or two, and I don't think I stayed sober hardly at all. He was out of town, and I know he'd gotten in this one night, and I was drunk. And the next morning, he came into my room, and he said, now, Esther, I'm not going to lecture you anymore, but he said, I want you to read this article. And he said, if you want to try this thing, I'll go along with you. But he said, if you don't, you will have to go home. He said, I cannot sit by and watch you destroy yourself anymore. So when he left, I thought, what is this crackpot thing? And I took two or three drinks so my eyes could focus. I don't see. I never will be able to see. And I could see this horrible picture, this awful drunk. I don't know if any of you ever saw it. He couldn't get the drink through his mouth. He had a towel around his hand. He needs a shave. And I shuddered when I looked at that. But from the very first paragraph on, something happened to me. I realized that there were other people in this world who behaved and acted like I did, and that I was a sick person, and I was suffering from an actual disease that had a name and symptoms, just like diabetes or TB. That I wasn't immoral, I wasn't mad, I wasn't vicious. And I don't know, it was just with a feeling of relief. I wanted to know more about it. And with that, I think for the first time came the realization that there was something horribly, horribly wrong with me. I think up to that time, I was so completely baffled by my behavior that I never stopped to think. And so, as I said before, I don't know how or why AA worked. I know that it was the first medium that ever reached me. And it reached me through this article. There was no one I could call or anything. I know that when Frank came home, I said, I want to try this thing. And he said, well, there's a post office box to write to in New York. And it's been very thrilling to hear so much about our service office during this convention. Because I am here just because of the service office in New York. And it's always meant an awful lot to me. Of course, we've grown so in the last 12 years that it's much bigger and a lot more different than it was then. But I wrote on Saturday. In fact, I was shaking so I wanted my husband to write the letter, and he said no. He had gotten enough out of it that it was something that I had to do all by myself. So I wrote this letter in this very shaky handwriting, and in just 1 week, back came a letter with the literature from New York. They sent me just the regular little letter they send to everybody else. But along with it, Ruth Hart wrote a little note in longhand, because she could read through the letter that it was written by me, that I really needed help, and her personal touch, I think, was something. Well, that was on Saturday, and my husband was leaving town on Sunday night, and he said, let's wait till I get back, and I will go with you to see this man. Frank left town, and Monday morning, I had been sober that whole week while waiting to hear about AA. And I wanted to try AA with my whole heart and soul. And I had learned an awful lot about myself in that one little article. And Monday morning, I was just feeling like $1 million left. With all you need is a half a pint of white swan, see? So I got a half a pint of white swan. And at midnight that night, I called this number. And the man who started the group was in the hospital. And they didn't know what to do with me. They're afraid to send any of the men to see me. And there weren't any women. So they let me stew in my own juice. However, I stayed drunk from Monday till Friday. And I call that my spill in AA. I'm glad I had it then. Because in spite of knowing that my drunkenness was a symptom of the things that were wrong with me, that's what the article told me, and that I could never drink again, I think I couldn't still yet face giving it up, and I was going to try. And I never want to forget that last drunk as long as I live. It was one of the worst I ever had. It was the first time in my life that I could not get a lift out of what I was drinking. And so on Friday night, May 16th, at 5:05, I had a half a water glass of white swan gin, and with it is when I asked God to help me. And I wish I could tell all of you what I think and feel about AA. But it's something that I have experienced, and I could never, ever put into words. I know that I only have a daily reprieve, that I must work at this as long as I live, but I do know that it's only at working at it that I will stay sober and live a happy life. And there are words of Dr. Bob's and Bill's that are with me all the time. You know, Dr. Bob said, love and service keep us dry. And Bill says, always we must remember that our first duty is face-to-face help to the alcoholic that still suffers. Dr. Bob tells us our program is simple and not so ousted up. It was the last thing I ever heard him say. And I think there are some of us that at times try to read mysteries and complexities into the steps. But they're not bad. To me, AA is within the reach of every alcoholic. It can be achieved in any walk of life. Because the achievement is not ours, but God's. And if there's anyone here for the first time, I would just like to leave you with the feeling that there is no situation too difficult, none too desperate, no unhappiness too great to be overcome in this great life-saving movement of Alcoholics Anonymous.